Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in. Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm the Big Mike, Mike Zlotnik, and today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome Alistair MacDonald. Hi, Alistair.
Hey, Mike. It's good to be with you.
Thank you very much for joining. Really appreciate it. Alistair comes originally from the land of Zimbabwe, and today he lives in Puerto Rico with his lovely family, wife and two teenage kids, and... So let's start with you and your family, a little bit about your background, your history, your family. And then Alistair is just such a bright mind. I met Alistair through the Freedom Founders Mastermind, and he was a keynote speaker. And when I heard him, I said, I love Alistair. He's just one of the brightest minds in the world. One of the few people I would love to have on my podcast. So I'm honored and humbled to have you on the podcast. Tell folks a little bit about you.
Thank you, Mike. That's a real compliment. I appreciate that. So yes, I'm originally from Zimbabwe in Africa. I'm a fourth generation African. My family has been there about 120 years. I grew up during a very violent civil war as Rhodesia was becoming Zimbabwe. And the brain drain that followed of this mass exodus of white then Rhodesians, now Zimbabweans, as they scattered all over the world for fear of generational repercussions of, fundamentally unfair policies and so forth. So recrimination fears and so forth got everywhere. So, but my family chose to stay. And I grew up in a long line of entrepreneurs. As far back as we can see, everybody's always worked for themselves. So the notion of getting a job or working for anybody was never really a possibility for me. So I grew up, talking to my dad about business the way he had his father, who had construction business and significant real estate holdings, 900,000 acres, 10,000 head of cattle, a lot of conversations over the dinner table about what is essentially arbitrage and economic opportunity. So that was the story of my life outside of the civil war and social conflict and so forth, which was the kind of soundtrack, the background to it. And I started my first business at 18 in the safari business. That then immediately, the timing was perfect and I enjoyed rapid success there, thinking that it was because of my own genius. It was largely just good timing. That led me into the investment business where I started gathering capital to pay for startup safari enterprises in very remote rural areas of Zimbabwe. That ended up with me working with clients from New York, moving to New York, working on Wall Street, and pulled me into the entrepreneurial investing world ever since.
That's a great introduction. And it's great to hear that you follow your family tradition, which is really important. And entrepreneurial nerve or entrepreneurial spirit is hard to teach, and if you're born with it or you learn it from your parents in early age is a huge lifelong benefit. So thank you for sharing. And what are you doing in Puerto Rico now? Just a little bit about your family. Why are you guys in Puerto Rico? Obviously it's a sort of a tax haven for the US US citizens, but just a couple of words. And
I've been visiting Puerto Rico now for some time, but making the jump last year was catalyzed in large part by historical precedent, really, on the macro scale. So I own a veterinary hospital, a 6 or soon to be 7 doctor veterinary hospital in Arizona, a dental practice. I'd have other health and dental business partnership in Canada. But making Puerto Rico my home is something I did a little over a year ago. In large part because of precedent. So my daughter is going away to college. She's just done her first year, finishing her first year of college. My son is here at school with me. And my wife goes back and forth and works some shifts at the vet hospital when needed. So precedent is, I'm a student of history and what it informs us in our strategic thinking. I find that there's a fascination amongst investors and entrepreneurs to focus on very small data sets especially those, they favor those that support the narrative that they are carrying or paying for or selling. So when we can dial up and increase our actual data set, I find that we get completely deeper perspectives and a broader understanding of the fluctuations of social mood, of interest rates, of geopolitical risks, and so forth. So, sorry, long answer. There's no short answers from me, Mike. I apologize. But we are enjoying generationally low tax rates right now in terms of corporate tax rates, especially capital gains and dividends and so forth. And it's just a matter of time. And I knew that this change was coming because it just follows. And unlike the standard narrative that it's red versus blue, or it's always done by Democrats, never by Republicans, etc., there's really no truth to that in the data. Interest and tax rates are always a function of demographic shifts and demands and the fluctuations between the number of people with the haves and the have-nots. And the ratio between the two of those is at the root of all tax policy. It is always about pleasing the people that account for the largest voting pool, always. So when we look at it that way, and we see the catalyst for me to grab my stuff and hit the road was COVID. Just to put in perspective, the initial salvo of stimulus of $1.9 trillion last year, initiated by a Republican, again, I don't really have much care of either party, but it's worth remembering that this stimulus launched by Republican initiative, of course, I understand, we have no idea what it is we were dealing with, everyone was afraid, of $1.9 trillion, was three times the size of the entire New Deal in inflation-adjusted dollars. In constant dollars, it is 300% the size of the New Deal. So looking at that, I say, okay, what did the New Deal give us? Gave us highways, bridges, roads, airports, massive infrastructure. What this 3X gave us was Netflix and DoorDash. There's no permanent mark that will be left on the P side of America's balance sheet, but only on the L side of the P&L, basically.
So,
and this needs to be paid for. So just to wrap this up is that this point about precedent, when we look at tax rates in 1929, we just take that same period. What followed that? So this has to be paid for some way. The top marginal income tax bracket in 1929 was 24%. By 1939, it was 64%. Capital gains were at 14% in 1929, and they were at 24% by 1939. So it seemed clear to me that the trap was set. We were just waiting for the match. And the match, I think, was COVID. And everything that's followed since then supports that thesis so far. So that was a huge catalyst for me to move down here, the lifestyle, the culture, et cetera.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation. It's the lifestyle and it's a little bit of that financial planning or foreseeing what's happening on the likely U.S. tax policy. And you're right, whether Democrat or Republican, we've had historically low interest rate, like you said, and now they have no place to go but up. And it's pretty obvious that it's happening. But the other thing that you really, that you said, that's kind of fascinating is where I wanted to go with this is you said that we're spending three times as much as what we did in the past in the biggest investment we made in the past. And this one is not really an investment in the infrastructure or great assets. This was more money in people's pockets, which is basically liability on a balance sheet and not necessarily a great sort of future value creation. Now we're going to tangent this into this discussion. So Japan has gone through this and they've done stimulus after stimulus after stimulus, trying to accelerate GDP growth, but they struggle. So their debt to GDP ratio is just out of control. They're at a point where they just can't get the economy going. So the big question is to the US, that package and then the follow-up packages, are they all going to be similar to Japan, where the money is going to go into sort of not great infrastructure investments with many years of benefits, but more of a kind of borrow, give people food instead of teach them how to, you know, don't give them a fish instead of teaching them how to fish. We've given people fish, but we haven't given people the future income generating assets. So can we explore a little bit, where do you think we're going with this massive expenditure? Are we going, and then the follow-up question is going to be, is it inflation, deflation? But let's just talk a little bit about, is this money going to help grow GDP at a good pace, or this is a bad investment and the GDP is going to lag the growth in debt?
Yeah, it's a great, great premise and great question. I'm always struck by irony wherever it shows up, which is often and a lot. When Japan rushed in to try to staunch the bleeding out of asset prices and the triple top that they saw in equities, commercial and residential real estate in 89, 90 and 91, they did exactly what the Federal Reserve is now doing, of, you know, increasing credit, increasing the amount of credit available to a handful of privileged institutions and lowering the rates that they charge those institutions. That represents the entirety of the Federal Reserve's true power, also the extent of their legal authority. The irony that just makes me laugh out loud is it was in the mid-1990s that a then young lackey from the Treasury Department named Timothy Geithner got on a plane with a bunch of other experts and flew to Japan and berated the officials over there for propping up zombie companies, saying, you've got to stop doing this. You're giving drugs to drug addicts. You've got to cut this out. It's only going to retard the eventual rebound and progress of the Japanese economy. And he was right, only to then find himself thrust into that same position of authority, you know, 15 years later, and prescribing exactly the medicine that he said would poison the patient in Japan that did. So at its core, the crucial piece here is a reminder of something nobody, and certainly nobody that is a hyperinflationist right now, is talking about, is the nature of debt itself. Debt is a taxation on future income. That's what it is. And we tend to, as a result, take on more of it the more optimistically we feel about the future. It takes a certain degree of personal optimism to buy a company, take out a 10-year note, and there's degrees of this optimism and how it manifests in society. Take out a car loan for 3 years, a business loan for 10 years, a mortgage for 30 years, and then, of course, become a parent, which is, if everything goes well, an obligation that you will support for the rest of your life. Not necessarily financially, but this will be your charge for the rest of your life. And sure enough, that's exactly what we see during peaks of asset prices. Consumers take on more personal, corporate, professional, municipal, and governmental debt. They have more children, they buy more homes, etc. And the other side of it is, of course, a contraction which reflects itself as a contraction in credit. Most recently, we saw that in 2008, 2009. So there are privileges that are afforded the Japanese that are not afforded the United States, not the least of which is the global reserve currency. That is not something that the Japanese had to deal with. Nobody had to trade in yen to buy oil or what have you. This is crucial. It means that we are accountable to non-Americans, many, many, many non-Americans, with some of the largest, deepest pockets and some of the largest investable interests on earth. Japan didn't enjoy this. The bulk of its mania, the Japanese market was largely homogenous and remains so to this day. Atypical, more money flowed into Japanese equities in 1992, 3 years after the peak, than prior to it. This is always foreigners showing up late. In the case of the United States, recent fund flows show the same thing. More foreign capital flowing into United States equities in the last 6 months than the prior 10 years. But we are already responsible for a massive amount of debt owed to many people besides ourselves. Dick Cheney mentioned years ago, just to show how completely misunderstood this philosophy is, that we can't go broke because we owe the money to ourselves. That's as intellectually bankrupt as it is morally bankrupt. I'm not going to forgive you your mortgage because you and I are Americans. This is ridiculous. Equally important, the capital that is held and invested by foreign nations. So we enjoy, we have a burden of responsibility that the Japanese didn't have. We also have a culture of far lower savings rates, which means we have less margin than the Japanese had. When the Japanese went into their bubble bursting, they had an average household savings rate of 12%. We were at 3%. That's a big difference. They're also a nation of that some would accuse of being very much focused on themselves. It's very hard. They've got effectively a zero immigration policy there. And so this unites a nation in a way that the United States, as evidenced by the response to COVID, is not united. We're just not. This gets into interest rates and who we owe the money to and so forth. And this myth, this very, very dangerous myth that the Federal Reserve will not allow interest rates to rise. We hear this all the time. It is a massive, massive misunderstanding of a basic fundamental principle of finance and economics and human behavior. It is never the lender that sets the terms. It is the borrower. What I mean by that is a lender could say, I'm not willing to lend unless you pay 10%. But if there are borrowers that can get a lower capital elsewhere, they will go to it. So we can think, we can believe that the Federal Reserve controls interest rates all the way across the yield curve and die of that superstitious disbelief or superstitious philosophy. Or we can embrace the fact that interest rates will always reflect a risk premium. That's what they are. And whoever owns them gets to dictate their value, not the person who issued them. Even Bill Clinton didn't know this. There's some
This is very fascinating. So a couple of quick comments and thoughts on this, because a lot of great nuggets. So first of all, the individual versus the kind of decisions whether to borrow money versus the government is a very different beast from the point of view the government, at least in its collective decision power, is sort of driven by the, you know, we live in a democracy, by the voters. And the politicians are very motivated to stay in power, and a lot of the decisions are based to please the constituents and to get reelected and continue staying in power. So for the U.S., the decision to borrow money, at least the way I see it, is not a decision whether we're going to put our children in debt. The decision is, are we going to keep the current politicians in power? And the only way to do this is to feed the masses, right? I mean, so the decision is already made. It's like in the Matrix movie, the decision has been made. You're here just to find out why. And the why is because politicians want to stay in power. Yeah. So that comment. On the final kind of, because I didn't get a clear answer, and I wanted to, so we understand what happened in Japan. Japan borrowed and spent, and they're not a reserve currency, and they couldn't trigger the economy out of the slump, and they basically have been in a very slow growth environment. So do you think U.S. GDP growth is going to follow Japan model, or it has a decent chance that it'll actually pick up, and we're going to pick up decent inflation, and as a result, you know, GDP will grow, you know, at some, you know, better pace than Japan did? Just a one simple question. And the other one, back to the interest rates. I guess if the GDP grows fast enough and the economy grows fast enough, then the interest rates can go up, theoretically speaking, right? I mean, the Fed, assuming the economy is growing, we got full employment. They got dual mandate, right? They got the full employment mandate, and then they got the, inflation mandate. If they keep both in check, they can let the rates rise. I mean, that's kind of a comment to your comment that it's almost, can the Fed let rates go up? And then the answer is they can. But let's go into that scenario. What's the real possibility of getting a decent kind of GDP growth in a decent inflationary environment here? Or are we going to run through the stimulus package one after the other, get through all that, at some point hit a wall, and then realize, whoops, that didn't work. What do we do now? And we revert back into some kind of contraction.
Yeah, well, certainly this will be a process and not an event. And it will be something that we'll have to navigate as we go. So there's going to be dynamism required in anybody's personal strategic plan. I'm certainly feel pretty well hedged against the possibility of inflation, though I consider it to be, for now, my working thesis is this is a transitional inflation. If we look at the mechanics, there is one caveat, though, which is wage inflation caused by the Stimulus Act, where we now have to pay more to our employees to stop them from taking unemployment, something we already saw last year. And this is a very real threat. I do think that post this kind of post-COVID euphoric burst that we've seen, just like the inflation numbers, we're looking at a year-over-year comparison. Everything's going to look amazing because we were in a black hole a year ago of uncertainty and crappy data. So it will look very impressive for first and second quarter of this year. But by the time we get to July or August, I think that reality is going to start to catch up with us again. And we'll see the actual drag of these policies and, unfortunately, the downstream negative consequences on private business owners who are finding themselves having to go to the open labor market and bid against a government who will pay people to do nothing. This is a very, very real threat. And especially in areas like dentistry, the veterinary industry, and so forth, where supply of labor is just not there. So it is my longer term concerns that our GDP will be, our real GDP, will be stifled by the powerful deflationary forces coming from around the world of demographics, debt being a taxation on future income, globalization, and technology. These are very, very powerful deflationary forces, all of them. And I think that that's going to continue to hamper growth in the United States. The inflation case, I am not completely sold on. Now, I'm very, very well experienced in inflation. I lived through the greatest hyperinflation on earth in Zimbabwe, paying laborers, employees twice a day, because what you paid them at lunch wouldn't buy them dinner that night. Where when you went out for dinner, you had to pay for the meal when you ordered it, because when it arrived, it cost more. So, and I've navigated these environments. And so I feel quite confident about my abilities going forward. There's a lot more in the inflation argument that I think people don't understand and why I'm not quite as concerned about this, but I'll stop there.
Well, the last piece was fascinating, right? You have to pay for your dinner before you order it, because by the time it's over, you get your meal served, the prices have gone up substantially. That is the ultimate hyperinflation. And so the follow-up question, is this a possibility in the United States that we hit a hyperinflation? What happened in Zimbabwe because of massive political instability and other risks, is this possible in the United States, or is this just, you know, it happens in other countries, but U.S. is sort of shielded from a hyperinflation possibility?
Yeah, I think that for the first time in America's history, significant inflation is actually a possibility now. It's actually a very low probability in my analysis right now, but for the first time, it's actually on the table. But that's not what concerns me. That will take some time for it to start showing up. And if anyone is looking for a canary in the coal mine, just watch the velocity of money. The velocity of money is the canary in the coal mine for our expectations about inflation in things outside of episodic spikes in lumber or coffee or what have you. When what we have seen ever since long-term capital management was bailed out in 1998 and this whole hyper-aggressive manipulation of markets by the Fed, and it is overt manipulation to support asset prices, is the velocity of money has imploded as the debt and fiscal efforts and monetary efforts from the government have been launched. The velocity of money has fallen, and with it, inflation has fallen too. So in Zimbabwe, when we're talking about having to pay people twice in a day, you can imagine what the chart on velocity of money looked like there. It was parabolic. That's something to watch.
Yeah, that's a key point. The money moved many times per day because it was not valuable to keep the currency, right? It was terrible to keep the currency. You have to get rid of it as fast as you can get it.
Yeah. $1 moving through the economy hundreds and hundreds of times in a year, whereas right now in the United States we're at about 1.2 rotations per calendar.
Why we slow down? Is it purely COVID? COVID slowed down velocity of money substantially.
Well, no, the money supply has been in a downward trend. Excuse me, money velocity has been in a downward trend, even more so by the Fed's accelerated by the Fed's stimulatory efforts during the financial crisis. There's a lot of great data on that. On the St. Louis Fed has excellent charts and so forth to show.
Is there a solution? Just a very quick question. If they st if the pe if Fed stops paying interest on the reserves that the banks hold, is that going to force the banks to get active and start pushing that money out?
That's such a great question, Mike. And the answer will be we have to look at the motivations because they've effectively done that. We've been sitting at an effective zero now for a while. And so what we do is we just go to the data of bank reserves and bank loans. And we see that bank loans are dropping and cash and bank reserves are skyrocketing. Why is this? And this is the crucial piece. This happens because you can make money for two reasons. The first is I might be able to borrow it at zero. Excuse me, but because my net interest, my margin of profit, I'm lending it back out for 2 or 3%. The mechanism that interest rates are supposed to serve as a risk indicator, it's a dashboard light that is broken. And so these banks say, now I have to assess and quantify a risk to lend Mike this $1 million loan for 3%. I can't do this systemically through my book of business without incalculable risk of default, because all it takes is a 1% rise in rates, and I've had a 30% increase in the cost of capital using that 3% example. So the incentive is not there for banks to lend with such tight margins. And those margins have collapsed as the Fed has tried to stimulate with cheap money. So they're just not being paid for the risk. And this is why bank reserves are climbing and loans are dropping. Fantastic article in Bloomberg on April 15th speaking about exactly this. They don't go into the cause of it. So that's crucial for all of us to be aware of. The second reason is any sort of, and this is the mechanism, this is the dysfunctional understanding of American inflation risks. The United States has a credit-based system. Zimbabwe, Weimar Republic, Argentina, Mexico have a currency-based system where actual US dollars are printed and exploded throughout the system, an order of magnitude. Yes, the Treasury has printed more money, but we've increased the actual percentage money supply is marginal compared to the credit that has been pledged to it. This is important. The ratio of actual dollars versus the mountain of ex explosion of credit. And credit is not money. Credit is not money. And if people don't believe me, try to pay your tax bill with your credit card for the miles and see whether or not the IRS accepts it. Credit is not money. So the problem here is that in a currency-based system in Zimbabwe, they could literally just print more money because the banks were owned by the government and they raise your interest rate. And now we've got an explosion of money velocity. More cash is in the system. In the United States, that's happened. But again, the credit promises off of it dwarf anything by an order of magnitude. A credit-based system doesn't enjoy the same forceful privilege of just pushing capital into the system because it requires two crucial things: a willing lender and a willing borrower. If just one of these people is a little afraid, a little uncertain, and not willing to do it, the whole system breaks down. And evidence of this is right inside bank reserves and bank loans right now. And you can't motivate, you cannot force somebody to borrow, and you cannot force them to lend. It's not worth it.
Yeah, Alistair, great thoughts, and I really appreciate your wisdom. We need to do this is part one. We need to do part two.
Okay.
I appreciate your wisdom. I would love to take more. I'm just back to back, and I gotta proceed to the
Understood.
next. Can we schedule another one? So we're gonna wrap this one up. This is just so awesome. Before we go, how would folks reach you? And then we'll do a part two maybe next week, and I'd love to hear your wisdom. It's just this is pure gold. We'll talk
Great.
about gold as another discussion.
Yeah, we should talk about gold. I think that would be a timely conversation. Honestly, at this, I don't have any sort of front stage websites. There's no click funnels. There's nothing at all. You can really find me best on Facebook. I'm a real person. Shoot me a message. We can always have a chat. I believe I have a website, alistair.vip, though I don't know if it's functional. So sorry for that.
Thank you for sharing. Your wisdom is just out of this world. A lot of
pleasure to be with
PhD economists should take a step back and listen to you, but I think they're motivated by different goals and objectives. Thank you again. Let's regroup. I beg you to schedule another call. Let's do part two, because this has been absolutely awesome. So thank you, Alistair.
Thank you, Mike. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's slot name. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.